Hello, and welcome to the Psychology Podcast with Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. Each episode will feature a new guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Hopefully, we'll also provide a glimpse into human possibility. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the podcast. Today, I'm really glad to have Brian Little on the show. Dr. Little is an internationally acclaimed scholar and speaker in the field of personality and motivational psychology. Professor Little is currently at Cambridge University, where he's fellow of the Wellbeing Institute and director of the Social Ecology Research Group in the Department of Psychology. He's also affiliated with the Cambridge Judge Business School and the Psychometric Center at Cambridge. His latest book is Me, Myself, and I. No, just kidding. His latest book is Me... His latest book is Me, Myself, and Us, The Science of Personality and the Art of Well-Being. Brian has been described as deeply informative, outrageously funny, and, quote, a cross between Robin Williams and Einstein. That what an awesome way to be described and very accurate, in my opinion. Thank you, Brian, for being on the show.
I'm delighted. Thank you, Scott. What a wonderful introduction.
Even though I totally butchered it.
Me, Myself, and I, indeed. Yeah.
That's totally not what your book is about.
No, the us actually matters, doesn't it?
It all comes together in that brilliant last paragraph of your book. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. That's the one paragraph that I'd like people to read, actually. They can skip the rest of the book.
Yeah, well,
they don't even need to buy it. Just go into the bookstore and read that last paragraph.
Well, this, you know, this us part is a kind of a common theme through this book, is that it's not just a personality is not just something that comes from within. You know, context matters. And also in creativity, I really liked how you talked about, you know, what about all those people that like supported, you know, those quote creative geniuses? You know?
The control group.
The
mute, inglorious folks who were simply the comparison group against which McKinnon's creative individuals seem to be so heroic. And that's something I think has been given relatively short shrift in the literature. And I'm very happy you picked up on that, because to me, that's a central issue. And I think what that does for those of us who study creativity is it deflects our attention away from the creative person to the creative project. And we often differentiate between the person, the process, and so on. These are very frequently invoked concepts in creativity research. But the creative project itself is really interesting, because I think that it is a sustainable pursuit of these core projects that matter in our lives. And the sustainability comes from motivation of the individual who's the creative one. But it also needs the touch of the less heroic one who tells the creative individual when things aren't going too well, or deals with the bank, or deals with the details of the administrative stuff that I'm thinking of the creative architect study. They hate details. They hate that kind of stuff. But their creative project would flounder if they did not have those support cast members around.
Yeah, you're referring to the famous IPAR study. And I didn't know that your office was down the hall from McKinnon's, who was the director of those of the study. I didn't know that you knew him. That's amazing.
Yes, I was his assistant for a short while.
Wait, on the IPAR studies?
Yeah, I was a teaching assistant for his course that he gave on creativity and the dynamics of behavior.
Did you meet Frank Baron as well?
Very little. We crossed paths, but I had more contact with Don McKinnon. Okay. Yeah.
What legends. Well, you're a legend too.
It was a really exciting time to be there. But Scott, it was 1964, and that was when the student rebellion, the free speech movement started. And there was this creative tension, as it were, between being so involved with what was happening on campus, on the one hand, and dealing with the academic side of things on the other. And McKinnon was quite a conservative fellow. And his course on the unconscious was fascinating, because I wasn't sure that he was really processing what creativity was being unfurled on the campus in those days. So as his teaching assistant, I had all sorts of interesting discussions with the students about just what is happening on campus and how it challenges the orthodoxy and how it tries to create a new regime in a conservative institution.
Did your paths ever cross with Abraham Maslow?
No, I was very much a George Kelly student.
That's clear.
And George Kelly visited Stanford when I was at Berkeley, and I went down to take his course, and he invited me to come to Brandeis the next summer and to meet with him and Maslow, with whom he had some agreement, but not that much, really. And that's a fun thing to get into, is where did Kelly differ from Maslow?
Well, I'd like to have that discussion.
Well, the whole notion of whether there's a self in you, and this is Rogerian as well, a whole self waiting to be discovered. George Kelly would have none of that. There's no inner you waiting to come out. You enact the you. You pursue it through the constructs you create to anticipate the future. And so I was very excited to go to Brandeis that summer. I happened to be, I'd left Berkeley to go to Oxford, and I was all set to go back to Brandeis, and George Kelly died in the interim. And it really hit me, because that would have been a wonderful opportunity to see if we could affect any rapprochement between the Kellyan view and the Maslowian view.
Unbelievable. That would have been just such a legendary meeting of three legends. So, I mean, this is, I'm absolutely obsessed with this idea of the self is an illusion. And, you know, there's modern neuroscience, and Bruce Hood, you know, talks about how the self is an illusion. And, you know, there is a biogenic self, as you talk about in the
yes. There Thanks for using that term. It encapsulates 40 other terms we have to use, like neuroendocrinology and so on. So biogenic works for me, and I'm delighted you used it. Thank you.
I like it. I like all the little like words you use. Like you coin like you're like Shakespeare of the. I'm gonna give you a new thing. You know, like Einstein and Robin Williams. I'll be like,
bless your heart.
So no, I like that. So there is something that it means to be you, DNA wise. I mean, you would be someone. You would literally be someone else.
Yes.
If I had, you know, 100% of your genes. Well, maybe not, because two identical twins who have 100% of the same genes, they're still not the same person, right?
That's right. And that's because of the imposition of what I call the other two natures, the sociogenic self, which is broadly used to refer to the impact of the environment and the cultural codes and norms that you are socialized into. And then what I regard as the emergent third nature, which is that which is driven by our aspirations, our goals, and particularly our personal projects. And they are what give meaning to us. And the self is often created through those projects. And that's where I think that I'm a little skeptical when I see the advertisements for the genetic whole genome analyses that you can do commercially now. I'd love to do one. In fact, I left a subtle hint with my kids that I'd love one for Father's Day. But when they advertise it as get to know the real you, well, not really in the sense of who am I really? Well, you're somebody that can detect whether you've eaten artichokes or whatever it is the night before because you have that particular gene. And I think the real concept of self comes through how you identify with and explore your values and enact your values through the projects that you take on during your life at different stages of the life cycle.
Yeah, you use the phrase new self. I like that phrase. Like we can create new selves that we've never had before through engagement in new projects.
Yes.
So, you know, there is this big theme in this book of the flexibility of personality. And I really like the idea of what the self is this bundle of values and goals and these kinds of things versus what we focus on in education, like standardized test performance and IQ and intelligence. And even I notice you don't equate the big five personality traits with who you are. But that's interesting because the whole introvert revolution, there seems to be one particular dimension of the big five where a whole bunch of people have made that a huge part of their identity. Absolutely fascinating phenomenon. And I get it in a lot of ways as a biogenic introvert myself. Like I appreciate wanting to own who you are, but doesn't it also lead to potential inflexibility?
Oh boy, have you got 7 hours? Now, I thought you would describe yourself in a wonderful piece you wrote as a neurotic extrovert. So that gets into some real, and now this is not an interview about you, but if we were back in Philadelphia and had a beer in front of us, I'd be talking to you about whether you are a biogenic introvert or more a biogenic extrovert.
Yeah. So I think that these things are tricky. Like, introversion has become something beyond, you know, when people say I'm an introvert and that's their identity, they're not referring to the technical definition of the Big Five.
You're absolutely right. I really have to tell you about something. For now 40 years, I've been lecturing on the introversion, extroversion dimension to large audiences in a whole bunch of different fields, teachers, physicians, corporate groups, and so on. And this really began in the 70s. And it was before the Big Five had really been articulated, of course, as you know. And the dominant model of extroversion was Eysenckian. I had great discussions at Oxford with Jeffrey Gray, not the Jeremy Gray, who you've worked with.
Oh, yeah. And Jeffrey Gray wrote the best book ever on consciousness, by the way, on the hard problem, consciousness.
He was a truly brilliant scholar. And I used to, after my talks on how extroverts and introverts differ in terms of the impact they have on their success, and that introverts tend to do better in school, they are more careful, they have a tendency to do detail work better than extroverts. So I would draw the picture of them as being estimable creatures. And people come up and say, I've never thought of myself that way. It's really amazing that there's something about us that you think is admirable. And I say, of course there is. And so that became, I guess, in a way, my shtick when I was talking to groups over the years. And then many, many, many years later, Susan Cain contacted me writing a book about this. And, you know, we chatted a lot about it. And she drew on some of my research in her book. And now it has become a social movement. And as we both know, because we're affiliated with the Quiet Group, that it has taken on a considerably lively force in social life. However, that said, and this goes right back to your initial question about identity, I'm seeing pushback. And the pushback's coming from the extroverts who are saying, hey, enough about these sensitive, thoughtful. Elaine Aron would have some concerns about this, but that depiction of introversion, because they're not totally overlapping. Right. But there is this tendency for them to be pushing back. That isn't as much of a concern as it is for me that some introverts are simply seeing them as themselves as nothing but introverts. They're ignoring the other four of Big Five dimensions. And once you start going through the Big Five to glom onto one identity associated with one pole of the Big Five, as you point out, and you're absolutely right, first of all, it's intriguing why that has happened.
It's a phenomenon. But
yeah, it really is. And the second thing is that I think it is dangerous because it decreases our degrees of freedom to enact our lives and craft our lives in a way that will redound to our values and to the things that really matter to us. And it can also serve as a pretext for not engaging with the world. And so if you, as we increase the degrees of freedom, and it's a phrase I like to use a lot when I'm discussing personality, by recognizing the strengths of introverts, the quiet strengths of introverts, as Susan so beautifully portrayed in her book, I worry that we not say that's all you are. For example, you may say, I don't want to go to the party, and now I am encouraged to speak up and say, hey, I'm okay. I just would rather curl up with a nice book tonight. That's great. But there's some recent research, I don't know whether you're familiar with this, out of John Zelensky's lab at Carleton.
Oh, yeah, he's doing
that. Has shown that introverts who, it goes to Dan Gilbert's work on being able to anticipate your future happiness. When introverts are asked to imagine what it would be like to go to a social event, they rate it as quite low. But when they actually go and experience it, they rate it much higher. And so acting extrovertedly for an introvert may actually have a salutary effect upon their well-being. If they identified strongly as an introvert and only assimilated that notion of this is who I am instead of accommodating to the possibilities of getting engaged, then I think they've shortchanged themselves.
No, absolutely. Yeah. There's so many things to unpack there, but I think a big, you know, the question about like, what am I? When I said I was a neurotic extrovert and I wrote that article, that was my attempt to like gently introduce the idea of multidimensionality to the public, you know, in my own, you know, quirky fashion. So that was like an exercise as a professor to people about how, look, on both these independent, they're independent dimensions. But, you know, the thing that's tricky is that like when I think Susan's great, a great person, and I really, really like her, and her heart's in a great place, and they're doing a lot to help people. So, but I feel like, you know, when I put my scientist hat on, I'm like, oh, you know what? I'm an extrovert on the Big Five because when it comes to positive emotions, I have lots of positive emotions.
Yeah.
And the other dimension is assertiveness. And, you know, I, you know, love asserting my wants and needs. But then I say, I read Susan Cain's books and I say, I'm an introvert. So it creates... I'm a Susan Cain introvert and a Big Five extrovert.
I have the same concern. And let me
do you know what I mean? So you know what
I do completely. I have erred, I think, on the side of invoking rather too much of the Eysenckian model of neocortical arousal and so on. I find that it's a model that works for certain areas, such as pharmacological effects, stimulant drugs and sedative drugs and their impact on performance and so on. I find it's more helpful to look at that from an arousal point of view than from a dopaminergic system engagement point of view.
Which is how Big Five researchers are strictly looking at it now as dopamine.
They are, And I think that's fine. But there's also a domain of performance that I think aligns better with the modified Eysenckian view. And when I said over the many, many decades, I am an introvert, I'm referring to neocortical arousal. Because I can't have caffeine after 4 o'clock at night and expect to sleep. When I have a lot of people talking to me, let's say halfway through a lecture and you've got a 10-minute break, I get so over-aroused. And it's not autonomic arousal. It's neocortical arousal that I'm flooding. I can't really process information. But then that can kick into autonomic arousal as well. And it's that biogenic introversion that I think can lead people like us. Both of us are highly agreeable, right?
Yeah.
So when we're on with our students, we love them to bits. But I don't know about you, but I overload with that. And I need to get away and escape at the break if I'm going to give a lucid lecture when I come back. If the lecture's over and I don't need to give a lecture, I don't need to perform at all, then I'm happy to have high fives and a lot of excitement with my students.
Well, this gets to the essence of the introversion extroversion dimensions, because Big Five researchers would listen to this conversation right now and they'd say, you're just describing neuroticism. Like, you're just describing like the neocortical arousal stimulation that's within the neuroticism domain. And it doesn't feel quite, you know, when I read these descriptions, you know, Susan is describing a phenotype that might actually be a blend of things, but it's still in itself a phenotype that a large swath of people are identify.
It is.
Even if it is a blend of Big Five traits, it's still a particular blend that a whole bunch of people are resonating with, including me.
Which
creates, you know, contrast because I'm like, you know, you call yourself a passionate introvert. So passion is like one of the facets of extroversion on the Big Five, enthusiasm.
Yes. You know? Scott, here is where we need to bring in what I call ideogenic nature, the part of human nature that derives from our core projects in our lives. And irrespective of my neocortical arousability, I have a passionate project, and that is to excite my students. And that means that I have to act out of character. Why? Because if you give a highly introverted, circumspect lecture at 8 in the morning, you're going to lose them. And so I've learned over the years to, as it were, act out of character. But, and now it's so wonderful to talk to somebody who really understands the psychophysiology of this. When I say that, I'm talking about acting away from my natural biogenic orientation. It may be linked to, and indeed, I'm sure there is some link with the dopaminergic system. And I'm more than willing to concede that. And I'm a big fan of Colin DeYoung's and his colleagues' aspects model. And you've been involved in that work as well.
He's one of my closest collaborators.
Yeah. And Colin is working with me. Incidentally, we're working right now on he's looking at the big five traits and personal projects in a...
No way!
Yeah. Which is so exciting. I can't wait to see what comes out of that. And that's funded by the Templeton Foundation.
Wonderful.
So we're getting these links finally building up so that we can create an integrated picture of the person, Scott.
I love this idea, the integrated picture of the person. Mm-hmm. And so let's talk about authenticity for a second. I mean, we know that as a explanatory variable, authenticity is a predictor of well-being. And you wrote this brilliant paper on personal projects in 1998, where you distinguish between happiness and meaning. And
that's with Ian McGregor.
Ian McGregor. And in the book, I noticed you didn't get into the nitty-gritty details of that study, but in your book, you didn't, but I want to discuss this paper because it blew my mind. So you found that integrity, to me, integrity is an important part of authenticity, right?
Yes.
So and some people use the phrases synonymously. Integrity in your projects, your personal projects, was correlated with meaning, but not happiness.
Yes.
However, and this is what blew my mind, acting out of character, in a sense, was correlated with happiness, but not meaning.
We're complex little creatures, Scott, aren't we?
Sure are.
And that's part of the delight of studying human personality. I've had some development in my ideas about authenticity recently. Our mutual friend Adam Grant has written a recent, I won't call it a screed, but a recent article on how perhaps we're overemphasizing authenticity.
It's an inverted U-shaped curve, at least.
He invoked that in there, but basically he's making an argument very similar to other arguments that have been proffered in recent years, that authenticity may have a limiting influence upon us. And I broached that topic, but I'm going to do it more in a new book I have coming out in the next few months, which is a TED book. And there's a chapter on authenticity in it. And here's my most recent thinking on it, that I think that there are three kinds of authenticity. Now, I like to use the word fidelity. You can show fidelity to your biogenic nature. That is, you can do what feels right. And this is the old hedonic notion of I am what I really want and need. The deep me is my biogenic me in our terms. Another way you can show fidelity and show authenticity in the sense of fidelity is to be authentic to your cultural norms. And you are a member of a particular ethnic group, or you are a student of a particular school, or you are from a neighborhood in a city. And that is me. That's a core me. You prick me and I bleed Philly or Yale in your or your ethnicity. And that
I resonate with Philly a lot more than Yale. trust me.
Well, you see, we've learned something already. And that has a claim on us, and sometimes in some cultures, it has an incredible claim on us. So that I studied it at Berkeley also with Ted Sarman, the role theorist, who used to let us know just how vital cultural scripts were. Literally, individuals can die from subscribing to a social role. If they are shamed, it may shut down their psychophysiology. Now, the skeptic in me would want to see more evidence on that. The claim is a fair one, that our culture can give us the signature of who we are in a way that can be really quite indelible. That's the old biogenic, sociogenic, the old nature-nurture dialectic playing out when we discuss these two. To me, and now we're going to get to integrity, the ideogenic self, the third nature, as a source of fidelity and a source of authenticity is the one that I think is really most important, because it is the self that I am, not because of my biology or my cultural entrainment, but the self I am because of what I have chosen to be and the projects to which I commit in my life.
You sound very Sartre-esque here for a second.
Le projet.
Well, this is like really an interesting conversation, because You know, the existential philosophers, you know, really believe he would love what you just said, you know,
yes.
Like, but, you know, Maslow, you know, would disagree. A lot of the humanistic psychologists were like, no, they're actually, they got it wrong. The existential philosophers, we actually, there is an essence to who we are that is influenced by our genes and that we can grow our potentialities, but we, you know, don't completely create our potentialities.
I would agree with that.
And both perspectives.
I don't think they're incompatible.
There you go.
We do have a biogenic nature. And like you as an agreeable person, I want everybody to be happy together, right? This has been one of the common themes in my work is, you know, can we actually get the biogenetically oriented individuals and the social constructivists together?
Yeah. I love integration. Yeah.
Well, I've written a couple of articles which have been distinguished by the lack of citations to them about the need for integration in personality psychology.
I love it.
But I think that it's entirely possible, unlike an existentialist or a Sartrean, I think it's entirely possible to give credence to the biogenic aspects of our nature and the sociogenic, and yet still have degrees of freedom left. But those degrees of freedom to enact the projects that matter to us, projects like take care of my mom because her cognitive decline is getting alarming, or the project of be there for my daughter during this trying time, or the project is enjoy myself with Dave because I love him more than anyone else in the world. These are the stuff of daily lives. They're not biochemical reactions. They're not social codes. They're the way we make sense of our lives. And I think that therein lies the groundwork for both identity and a sense of integrity, a sense of value exploration, and a sense of true authenticity. Does that make sense, Scott?
It absolutely does. But then, so that explains your meaning finding, but then explain to me why acting in like doing things that might be like complementary or like, you know, maybe fulfill a hole in who we are actually can make us happier. That's how I interpreted your findings.
Yeah. The best answer to that is that I found it really hard to explain that. And I thought Ian McGregor, who is a senior author on this and a really fine scholar who's now at the University of Waterloo, I think he did a great job in explaining it. I'm still puzzled by that finding. All I can say is that I invoke often, and I do in the book, the notion that it's not the pursuit of happiness, but the happiness of pursuit. And there can be happiness that emerges as a consequence of enacting challenging roles or projects that ask us to act out of character. And we say, wow, look what I'm doing. I'm standing in front of 400 students, and they're loving it. Or I'm running for public office. I've never done that before, but I'm happy I'm doing it.
Oh, I'm just loving this conversation. I just have like a million questions I want to ask you.
I think we began this in Philadelphia a year ago.
We really did this conversation. I miss you. I'm like,
yeah,
I'm
you
sad that you're not in Philly anymore. So we, you know, there's this constant tension between our drive for self-understanding and authenticity and right. Our drive for personal growth. And they are, you know, they're compatible with each other. Carl Rogers often talked about how once we accept ourselves, then we can truly, only then can we truly grow. And he talked about that in a lot of ways. But there's a balancing act. What is the right optimal balance there between like eventually just like wanting what you have versus having what you want? So there's actually some interesting research kind of distinguishing between those things. And ultimately, they say that the greatest predictor of happiness, I don't know if you saw this paper, mm-hmm. they found the greatest predictor of happiness was being okay with like wanting what you have, like who you are, and growing along those lines, as opposed to having an idealized self that really is so far away from who you are that you're like not happy with you who you are.
I agree.
If that makes any sense.
Absolutely. I think that when I talk about free trades, and the example I've used is introverts such as myself acting as pseudo extroverts, we talk about the downside of this, that it can lead to burnout and so on. But one thing that is really crucial that you raise is that it is a chance to expand yourself. And there's increasing evidence, as you know, because you're on top of the literature thoroughly, that there is increasing evidence that you can actually change genomic structures by social processes and the projects you engage in. If you are chronically lonely, that has an impact upon your biogenic self. When I began
epigenetics?
What's that?
Is that epigenetics?
It's similar to epigenetics, indeed. And 10 years ago, even, I would have thought this was really, it sounds like Lamarckian. And I would have thought that it was highly implausible. But increasingly, there's evidence of the interdigitation of the sociogenic and the biogenic. And I think part of what brings that interplay into effect is human action. The things you commit to, the projects you pursue, in which you have an interplay of your genetic propensity, the affordances provided by your environment, and there are consequences both downstream to your well-being and backstream to your relatively fixed traits. That is really exciting. And that goes way beyond my competency to speculate on how that research might develop. But I know it's going on, and it's exciting.
Yeah. Exciting. And these, you know, you say relatively fixed traits, but I really like the Fleeson model of density distributions. So personality is density. So that we all act out of character a lot throughout our day, in the sense that we all are all through all five levels of extroverts, introverts, all of those things. Throughout our day. So in ways, it kind of confirms a lot of your research that he just found that with experience sampling, I guess.
Exactly. And, you know, some of the time we'll have a conversation about the difference between experience sampling and personal projects, because projects subsume the kind of data that comes with experience sampling. But let me say a little bit about Will Fleeson and his work. I think it's terrific. And I'm very much in agreement with Will's work. I came at it from a slightly different perspective, but I've never really developed this thoroughly. I wrote about it in the Handbook of Environmental Psychology, or was it the Handbook of Personality Psychology, Pervin's volume, the second edition of it. Somewhere I talked about Buss and Craik's model of the act frequency approach to dispositions, where they talked about dispositions as being the relative frequency of being engaged in acts that are prototypical in a Roshian sense of each of the big five traits, for example. So during the day, you may engage in 16 acts that are quintessentially or prototypically extroverted and four that are introverted. And you look at, and I thought that act frequency, which is not unrelated at all to Will's work, was really quite brilliant. Jack Block attacked it. Part of his attack was, I think, bang on, but unnecessary because it wasn't crucial to what David and Buss and Ken Creek were arguing. But I took a slightly different view, and this is where my George Kelly approach comes in. I developed what I called an act saliency view. It's not the acts that you engage in terms of their frequency, but what you think you're doing that is really pivotal to understanding your personality. And the example I gave, it was an environmental handbook chapter. The example I gave is that you may see a fellow who spend all summer and deep into the autumn in camping gear, going out to the lake, casting his fishing rod, chopping down trees, and generally acting in such a way as that we would call him a rustic warrior. And I actually pointed to some environmental disposition characteristics that he would be very high on. But we may be sadly mistaken. The reason he is engaged in those prototypical acts of the outdoorsman isn't because he's outdoorsy. It's not that he has a stable trait. It's that his wife is dying, and he loves her deeply, and she loves going into the woods. And this is their last chance to do that. Scott, this is, to me, what the human condition is about.
Absolutely.
You can't just look at the prototypical acts, at the density distributions, and expect to engage fully with what a human being is. It offers us a terrific inroad, and it's necessary, but it's not sufficient for understanding what I think human personality is all about.
I actually want to stop right there because I thought there's nothing I could possibly say that would be more profound than that.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for this chat, Brian, and everything you've done in the field.
Wonderful questions. Thanks so much. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Psychology Podcast with Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman. I hope you found this episode just as thought-provoking and interesting as I did. If you'd like to read the show notes for this episode or hear past episodes, you can visit thepsychologypodcast.com.